And you're listening to your community radio station. It's KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K224CQ Anahola, K284AL Halaiva. It's time now for In the Garden on the Farm.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
Aloha and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Robin and Paul, and on today's show, we will hear a report from one of the world's most cutting-edge conferences, pick some fresh leeks from the kitchen garden, and lay down some useful tips for a first-rate feasting. But first, we'd like to let you know that this KKCR program is made possible by listeners just like you, in partnership with our fine sponsors.
Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe in Hanalei is proud to support KKCR and its Ohana, offering organic groceries and produce, a cafe featuring fresh salad bar, hot meals and soups, fresh-made smoothies, and baked goods. Located in the heart of Hanalei, Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe, 826-0089.
Kauai Marine and Mower, located in Old Kapa'a Town, is proud to underwrite this KKCR program. Kauai Marine and Mower features Honda garden and lawn equipment and also Echo power equipment. 823-0556.
Anahola Stringed Instruments is proud to support KKCR. Mickey Sussman has been building Island Koa guitars, ukulele, and violins on Kauai since 1972. Time-honored design and special orders. Prompt and complete restoration, repair, and reforestation. AnaholaStringedInstruments.com or 822-1645.
The Kauai Store is located in Kapa'a on the highway in front of Kahula. The store has authentic Kauai products including clothing, snacks, art, coffee, crafts, and more. We even have local food samples. The Kauai Store products are also available online at thekauaistore.com.
Ah, the beautiful birds of Kauai.
Mm.
We love them, and we thank David Kuhn so much for exploring deep into the Hawaiian forest to bring back these beautiful natural sounds that inspire us to take action in concert with the beautiful gardens and farms of this island to bring productivity and delicious, bountiful food into our kitchen and onto our table.
Mm-hmm.
Robin, how are you?
Wonderful.
It's grand to see you.
It's great to be here.
Mac, thanks so much for being with us. And we are excited to share some celebratory just energy with you today and our focus on feasting, bringing, again, the most out of all of these ingredients that we've grown or that perhaps we've picked up at the farmer's market. And we're going to get to that coming up in the show. We've got some other nuggets of knowledge for you as well. But we'll start with a celestial session. And we do that each and every week to sort of ground in and set our sights to the heavens for inspiration and guidance on our planting, harvesting, and other gardening and farming activities. And we begin to honor the Hawaiian culture and to receive the ike, or wisdom of the Hawaiian culture, by looking at the Hawaiian moon. And today's Hawaiian moon is a very special one to us planters of the Hawaiian Islands. It is Mahealani. We want to thank the 2015 Hanalei Moon and Tide Calendar and the Hanalei Watershed Hui for this information. Mahealani will rise over Kauai at 7:37 p.m. this evening. She'll reach her transit, her highest point in the sky, at some point tomorrow morning. I didn't actually write it down, goodness. But I can say for sure that she'll set at 10:53 a.m. tomorrow. 97% of the moon's beautiful face will be illuminated, and we had the full moon reaching her peak of fullness yesterday at 2:05 a.m. So this is a slightly waning moon at 97% of size that we will observe today if the clouds part and we can see her beauty and her fullness. But either way, whether we have a cloud cover or not, we're going to have a bright night tonight.
I've really enjoyed seeing the moon in the early morning, this morning in the west. So bright, so beautiful.
Lovely. Mahilani literally meaning heavenly haze and heavenly moonlight. And this is a good day to recommend planting of all things if we choose for them to grow with much energy and into their fullness of expression and bounty. So it's a great day for all work in the garden and farm. So I hope you got a good night's sleep and you have an opportunity to step out and enjoy that time. The moon's influence, this particular moon, the influence begins upon its rising at 7:37 p.m. So the moon I've just described, Mahialani, actually has its influence more tomorrow than today.
I see.
But another good day for all activities during these multiple full moons.
Sure. I imagine that in the past, when Mahialani moons came around in the summer, it was really nice because you were able to garden at night when the air was cooler and you weren't melting under the midday sun.
Yes.
of summertime. And I can see why this would be a great moon for planting. Well, you know, looks like the same thing in the biodynamic look at things. We've got planting time going on Wednesday through Friday. The moon will be in Taurus, an earth sign, so we can work with our root plants. Sounds like some collow or sweet potatoes might be a good choice there. Over the weekend, the moon moves into Gemini, an air sign, so we can work with flowering plants at that time and think about planting some of our winter flowers, which for me means calendula usually, maybe nasturtium, seem to like the coolness. But then there's, of course, all those beautiful tropical flowers that fall into that category too. And Monday, Tuesday next, the moon will move into the watery constellation of Cancer, so that'll give us time to plant some leafy plants. For me, this is my favorite lettuce season of all time. We get to grow romaines and butterheads and all those nice cool season lettuces for starters, not to mention all the wonderful kales and other garden plants that are so delicious.
Yeah. Ooh, you're setting the stage for a great discussion on feasting. I can imagine all these crops growing beautifully, a beautiful row of great diversity of leafy crops and the taro doing well, the leaf blight back on our taro plants up in Kalihiwai. So
dang.
Just trying to maintain and realizing the more beneficial microbiology that we bring into the system could help to ameliorate that problem, hopefully. Maybe thinning the plants a bit, too, to allow for more
airflow
between the leaf canopies. But, gosh, interesting. The challenges that arise during the process after all the careful preparations. But we sally forth and continue on to continue those traditions. And we're going to take a look at some notable news.
Right. So last week, and I do hope everybody enjoyed the two talks that we aired, one by Sandra Katz about fermentation I thought was really fascinating and practical. And then the second talk from Michael Pollan was from the Bioneers Conference a few years ago. And it turned out that the reason we chose those topics is because Paul was at the Bioneers Conference in California last week. And so I'm counting on hearing a little report from you about how wonderful it was.
Well, it was indeed wonderful. Great to go for the first time. And I was accompanied by Felicia. Got to sit in on her show yesterday, Kauai Soapbox, and talk a little bit about our journey as well. Dr. Larry Magnuson was with us, so we formed a trio representing Kauai. And we went with great intention to connect, network with the conference promoters or the conference presenters as well, and to find out how we could link this amazing global effort to overcome climate crisis and ecological and social justice crises that we face. A lot of great minds coming together, 2,000 people in attendance in their 26th year. So a very well developed conference, very well produced, well attended. It's definitely seemed like, you know, preaching to the choir of a sort, but preaching out of some new, you know, maybe out of the newest testament, and filling us with a sense that we're moving in the right direction. We've got the right minds on the problem. Highlights for me, participating in the seed exchange, probably 200 people from the conference and outside the conference were able to attend that. We did wind up visiting a seed trial farm out at Point Reyes Station with our friends Matthew and Astrid from the Living Seed Company, and a great configuration of seed enthusiasts and members of First Nation tribes participated in that day, which was very special time. And Bioneers, we're looking at ways in which we can continue to bring that kind of content here, showing some of the sessions that happened, bringing speakers who formed part of the sort of the keynote addresses and that kind of thing. And also we want to let people know that Bioneers has a radio series. And KKCR 12 years ago broadcast a lot of these series, but we're back at it again. And the Bioneers radio show airs on KKCR. It's part of the Mixed Plate Mondays from 5 to 6 p.m. It'll be a couple times a month. Check out the schedule at kkcr.org. But you can also go to the Bioneers website, and Robin's going to tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, which I was inspired to do once I knew Paul was going. And I've certainly heard of the Bioneers before, but didn't know a whole lot about them. They've got some pretty cool programs. The website is www.bioneers, like pioneers, but with a B, bioneers.org. And some of their programs are include Resilient Communities Network, which I just love the way that sounds. That's definitely what we need in our communities nowadays, as things are just not really business as usual, like maybe they used to be. Restorative Food Systems. So there's a whole group of people who are just working on making food in a really sustainable way that's not damaging our environment just to feed us, thereby, you know, kind of stepping on our own foot. There's Bioneer Youth Programs, you know, sponsoring youth, getting young people involved in these kinds of things. And I always think that's a great idea because young people have innovative ideas that maybe some of us just haven't thought of before. And when they're given some voice and credibility, it's pretty amazing what they can come up with. Every Woman's Leadership is another program that Bioneers does. It's definitely empowering to women. And then Indigenous Knowledge is another one of their programs. So digging deep into knowledge that's already there and honoring the elders who still carry it and giving them a place to share it and speak it, a platform.
Yes, such a perfect fit for here on Kauai, where we have such a strong cultural identity and mission to overcome the challenges that we face. You know, one particular session that meant a lot to me, and I'm looking forward for the follow-up on this one, was a session on Cuba's organic agriculture. A lot of our listeners have probably seen the great film about how Cuba overcame the fall of the USSR and basically fell into a huge challenge with the sanctions imposed by the U.S., and they basically couldn't get food. They couldn't get many of the basic supplies we just depend on a daily basis. They had to turn to intensive urban and just countrywide organic agriculture using minimal inputs. And they've been doing that now for decades. And because of the necessity factor, they've been extremely assertive in their ingenuity and their implementation, and they really have a lot to teach the world about ecological agriculture. So now, in one of the sessions, one of the gentlemen, Greg Watson, who's the former Massachusetts Secretary of Agriculture, but also serves on a nonprofit board that has taken on creating a network of growers, is working to link Cuba with the U.S., not from a governmental diplomatic standpoint, but literally connecting Cuban farmers to U.S. farmers so that we can exchange best management practices and technologies, and all geared toward producing food that's highly nutritious with minimal inputs, you know, using horse-drawn plows as an example of the kind of technology that they've just become experts at again. And so more information for this can be found by doing a web search for the Cuba-U.S. Agroecology Network. I think it was important, too, to discover that there were no collaborators yet from Hawaii, and Cuba has such a similar...
I was thinking that.
It's such a similar climate and soils. In fact, if you follow our latitude around, the same latitude intersects... Kauai intersects Cuba. So, I mean, we're
about
extremely
north.
Similar. Yep, 23 degrees north latitude. And the soils, they have the oxisols that we have that are highly depleted, and they're finding solutions. So it's going to be really exciting to join the network, to link other people here in Hawaii with the network, and I think we stand to learn a lot, and hopefully we can also share a lot of our advances with them.
Yeah.
Too. So that was one of the most exciting parts for me about Bioneers.
Yeah, very cool. Well, yeah, on the website, you can watch Bioneers videos. So there's actually videos of some of the lectures that happen at the conferences themselves. If you can't make it to the conference, there's media collections that they sell on their website. And then you can also, if you don't catch every one of the Bioneers radio programs here on KKCR, you can also access those from that website, www.bioneers.org. Mm-hmm. Pretty cool, pretty thorough, and inspiring website to me.
Indeed. And I want to give a special thanks to our great friend Larry Magnuson, who has gone to Bioneer several years. He's identified the importance of linking that nationwide and even global effort with our efforts here on Kauai. He paved the way for Felicia and I to be able to join him this time at Bioneer. So I want to give our great thanks and let him and all of our listeners know we'll be working hard to establishing and strengthening that link in the coming year.
Very cool. Well, now let's establish a link with our kitchen garden. You know, I always say the kitchen garden should really be about 25 steps away from the kitchen door, something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's real easy to get there, and you're going to be more likely to go out and forage before dinner time, yes. See what you can find. What I'm finding these days are leeks, and I planted some really off-season leeks. Just had some sitting around, I guess, and put them in the ground kind of late, divided them even later. Normally people would be planting leeks right about now, and here I am harvesting them. So go figure, off-season leeks, pretty much any time of year on Kauai, I've had success growing them. So Allium. Oh, let's see if I don't slaughter this Latin name. Ampelopressum.
Nice.
Allium ampelopressum. There it is, the leek. I know a lot of girls like leeks, but they're good for guys, too. I know they're good for women in the later part of life when we kind of go through our change. Oh. They've got really good properties for us. But we'll start with planting them in well-drained and fertile soil is the best choice. Definitely don't like to be soggy. That's the worst thing that can happen to alliums in general. We like trenches, and or at least cultivated leeks that you're going to find, say, in the grocery store, ones that maybe weren't grown on Kauai, and people here do grow them deep in trenches, and the whole point of that is so you can keep hilling up the soil around them, and you get this very long white stalk. It's white because it's deprived from sunlight and it's not photosynthesizing. Mm. And those are kind of considered, you know, chefy-wise, the gold. But phytonutrient-wise, the greens are actually much better for you, even though they taste more pungent. They're not quite as sweet. I make it a practice to just cut up the whole leek. Mm. I use the white and the green all together. In fact, it's I kind of think my most magic ingredient in my stir fry.
Mm. And when it's white, it's also more tender?
It's more tender, correct, yeah.
And so sometimes does the greens, maybe you would be less inclined to use them in a particular dish or something because they're too tough?
I'm certain some chefs would be, maybe because you can use leeks raw, thinly sliced white. The white part of the leek could be used raw as a garnish. And so, yeah, I think most of the time people wouldn't eat the greens, but I'm here to tell you they have more nutrition in them, so I would totally use them. And when I cook them into a stir fry, they're soft enough to eat. There's nothing particularly stringy about them. One of the things to know about them is they just like to collect dirt between the folds of their leaves, whether you hill them up or not. So cleaning them is almost impossible when they're whole. And a little trick I've learned is to, after I slice them, I put them in a bowl of water and float them, and all that little tiny grit and sand will float away. You know, then you can strain off the water and let them dry a little bit before you decide to put them in your food. They mix well with vegetables, cream, butter, cheese, seafood, and eggs. What doesn't, I guess, is my question. But certainly a really popular way to consume them is potato leek soup, or vichyssoise, as they say in French. Extremely delicious, but they're great in frittatas or quiche. And like I said, in either fried rice or stir fry, they're definitely one of my magic ingredients there. Mm. They're a great source of flavonoid antioxidants. They're low calorie. They're high in fiber. Certain properties have been known to reduce cholesterol of the leek, vitamin A, C, K, even vitamin E, which I found really interesting. But a leek, I always think of vitamin E as something a little more oily. But there it is, B-complex vitamins, carotene, and even lutein, which is one of those things that's also in tomatoes and carrots that's good for our eyes. Mm-hmm. So get your leeks if you're not growing them now. Winter is a nice time to get them in the ground. Harvesting in the spring, they do take about 120 days to reach a maturity. Although, you know, if you really need the leek, you can pick it younger and smaller. Nicer when they get a little big, but
yeah. Cool. And now on to growing them. Favored varieties that you like?
Yeah, I like Bleu de Soleil is a French variety that's really beautiful, and the King Richard leek has also done really well for me. These are two heirloom varieties that I prefer, mainly because one day I dream that I'll leave a couple in the garden and see if they'll go to seed for me.
They will.
So I could collect it. Well,
for you, they will.
If they don't make it to the kitchen first, that's right. The problem with me. Sometimes I'm kind of a piggy and I just eat them all.
And then are they separated into long season, short season like onions are, or there's no real designation?
Well, that's the interesting thing about the leek. It's a non-bulbing allium, so it really doesn't have a season in that regard. I can say they don't love summer, even though they don't like being wet. Summer's a little bit tough on them. But mine made it through. Mine made it through August and September this year, which, you know, pretty impressive.
And if you're in a cooler, rainier climate like I find myself, they seem to be solid in the garden. And they will go to seed if you have enough out there and you're not thinking about the next recipe they're headed toward.
Sure. So. Are they crossers or will they kind of do themselves? Do you need to have a little bit of a population size to get quality seed on those?
Cannot say. I mean, certainly more than one, but I would have to come back with that answer.
Yeah, I don't know either. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a nice segue into our feasting and preparation talk that we're going to do today. And, you know, feasting is a very big part of Polynesian culture, way into antiquity. Polynesia, Meganesia, Melanesia, all of these South Pacific islands have deep roots in feasting. And we want to talk about first is, like, well, what do they feast for? What are the occasions? One that's lingered into the modern world that we're all pretty familiar with is the baby's first birthday luau. And that's a beautiful blessing for the baby's life and lots of abundance, symbolizing a great and healthy and abundant life for the baby.
Yay. Yeah. And the fact that it survived the first year.
Yes.
Maybe bad luck to celebrate on the day of birth of the baby or near the birth is like, better wait until see, you know. But we had the pleasure of speaking briefly with Donovan Kabibi before the show, and we set the question to him about what other times during the course of life in ancient Hawaii might feasting be observed, and he gave us some good insight, which included the birth of a king, queen, or other member of the ali'i class would be a time. So that would be an exception to the first to the first year observance, but just the arrival of a being that was exalted as the link between us humans and the gods.
Right, and also I imagine victory in war would be a time when feasting would happen. And then, oh gosh, I just lost my thought, unfortunately. What was it? It was related to...
Well, certainly there were planting celebrations, so the completion of a new taro lo'i would
right.
be celebrated with a feast. We know about the feasting that was conducted before planting mai'a, or banana trees.
Correct.
A great feast would be made to inspire those new plantlets to produce a tremendous amount of food.
Sure. And, oh, it was makahiki. I know that's coming up, and I wonder if there was could be some feasting involved.
I would imagine.
Around that holiday as well. Well, so today we're going to talk about feasting on the healthy fare that comes from our farms and gardens here on our beautiful island, with a focus on peeling, shredding, chopping, and preparing food with our cutting boards rather than a can opener, opening cans or opening packages. And this, I think, is one crucial point, is with the feasting culture, it was healthy to feast on wild pig and fish and poi and fruits. But when the modern civilization came around and more processed foods that, you know, affect our cholesterol and our blood sugar levels in different ways, and you start feasting on those, that's where problems begin. Obesity sets in, and some of those dietary-related diseases like diabetes and heart disease and stuff. So today, as you could have well guessed, you know, we're going to talk about feasting on really good, clean, kawaii-grown food. And although there's a whole lot involved with preparing a feast, we thought we'd start out with the cooking methods, because, you know, you don't really want to get to chopping until maybe you have your emu built or, you know, your fire started or however it is you're going to choose to prepare food. So, you know, we can slow cook things, and really, like, kind of the ultimate slow cooker is the emu. And, Paul, I think you got a little bit to say about that.
I do. Well, anyone who's been to a luau here in the Hawaiian Islands, or perhaps further afield in places like Fiji, Samoa, or all the way back east to New England, has experienced an underground earth oven, perhaps. This is a cooking, certainly one of the most ancestral cooking forms. You don't need to have invented pottery to create an earth oven. You just need to dig a hole in the ground. And certainly, like so many of the most ancient traditions of humans, was probably observed to be occurring near some lava formation, some volcanic activity, or perhaps during the course of a forest fire. A pit was, superheated with wood from a giant forest fire. You can imagine falling into a pit and then perhaps an animal being trapped in there and being cooked up, and then humans observing and going, wow.
That worked great.
I could make that happen if I copied nature's wisdom. So this is a very common practice of cooking food, as Robin said, in the various parts of the Pacific Rim, but also in Morocco, Greece, and uncommonly in Europe, there have been shown to be earth ovens. And basically the practice here is steaming food. And so it was funny to remember, as somebody who grew up in New England, that the New England clam bake, that we would enjoy the results of. I have to say, I never actually participated in the preparation of a clam bake, but I did see them being unearthed for a feast. And this was a tradition that was passed over, or at least adopted, from the First Nation people of Turtle Island, or what is now the continental United States, of cooking seafood in a pit dug in the sand, and then using seaweed as the agent that causes the steam. But basically the process, well known to many, basically digging a compact hole, placing your fire in there, some well-chosen stones, although I've heard differing reports. I was taught to use the porous basalt or the porous lava stone and not the smooth ones, because it's much less likely that they would explode in a fire because they can breathe. So you're wanting to use more of the Swiss cheese-like rock. However, our buddy Phil uses the flat stones and says he's never had a problem in all the emu he's made. So you can follow your own guidance on that one. And basically, it's kind of like making a sweat lodge fire. You're placing these stones, and of course, the collection of the pohaku, or stones, is something that is perhaps one the most mindful part of all of this, that we need to be very careful when we're not taking stones from any ancient either structure or utility from the land. I was taught that collecting stones from a stream bed is the safest way, because even if they used to be part of an ancient Hawaiian construction, it's been recycled back into the environment. So either stones from there, from the ocean, is what I was taught. But again, that's something that needs to be done extremely mindfully and with your own research about how to make those best choices. And without going into too much detail, after the fire is made, the stones are hot. Couple of layers at least of very moist, or plant material that's very high in water. Banana stalks are the best, shredded and cut lengthwise, and then topped with a layer of tea leaves, are placed over the stones before the food packages are placed within, which are often tied up in tea leaf or banana leaves. And then this is followed by further a layer of tea leaves and banana leaves, and then leaves as opposed to the stalk now of the banana, and then covered over. These days people do use plastic tarps, wetted burlap bags. But I also read about the use of cardboard, which felt a little bit nicer to me than using a plastic wrap at the top. And then soils covered over the top. Depending on what you've put in the earth oven, it could take 6 to 8 hours to cook a whole pig properly. But smaller vegetarian emu or emu with cut-up meat is going to cook a lot faster than that. But you certainly want to make sure it's done, because once you unearth it, kind of hard to put things back in again.
There's no going back.
Yeah,
that's right.
You might have to finish up your Thanksgiving turkey in the oven if it didn't get completely cooked in the ground. I've been party to that experience before. And it imparts a very special flavor to the meat. We're familiar with the kalua pig, and it was fun in doing my research to realize the word kalua means the hole. So a lua being a hole, and it's a hole. It's the food that comes from the hole in the ground.
Right.
I was always wondering what that word meant. But if you want to read more and see some great photographs, there's an excellent article on the subject by Dino Labiste with photos of every step of the process, and that's available at primitiveways.com. And so enjoy that. And yet, if we're not cooking in an emu, we have lots of other options, because that is an extremely labor-intensive, a super way to connect with the environment, all of the, you know, the elements. You've got the stone, you've got the earth, you've
got
the fire and the water and the food as well. So certainly an elemental experience.
Absolutely. And, you know, something that you do when you're having a big party. You know, you're not going to cook up one dig an emu to cook a pumpkin. You know, you're gonna put a lot of food in there. So great for big events. And otherwise, on a small scale, in your own little oven, whether you want to do a wood-fired, we have a wood-fired oven, which, you know, generally we cook pizzas in, but it's a wood oven. So the oven inside of the oven is my favorite way, as in the Dutch oven. Mm. And I do love the cast iron ones, although I've been experimenting with clay bakers recently, too. The most common or famous one is the Rahmertoff, the Roman terracotta clay baker. But there's also the tagines that are used in Morocco, those cone-shaped ones. And I've got some black clay ones that are from Colombia. They're beautiful. But the covered oven is really where it's at. The casties you can do on an open fire by putting coals from that very fire on top of the lid, and you create an oven right there out in the open. You don't even need an oven, but the oven inside of the oven works quite well also. But open fires are great because you have the ability to grill things if you want to grill them, or you can just use pots and boil things in water. We love cooking over open fire. It does add an element to the food that does change the flavor no matter what.
And I'm pretty sure that if you're using a fire to cook on, it is still legal in the state of Hawaii to
yes.
make a fire. It's one of the reasons that actually substantiates the making of a fire.
That's right. We've been through the whole fire ban thing, and the people of Kauai, nay, came out strong that we want to be able to cook over fire, and I'm really proud that people spoke up on that, because that's such an important part of our food culture. So basically, having said all that, you know, you want to harvest your produce. We've already talked about that in detail, so we won't talk about that. Always a good idea to wash or scrub the produce, you know, after it's been picked, and make sure it's nice and clean. You're going to want to have a good knife. You're going to want a good peeler, even a food processor. I've had a lot of fun with these slicing blades that I never used to use, and now I'm using them to great effect. And my friend Natalie over the weekend was telling me about this really cool food processor, the high end for people who are making lots of food for feasts, the Robot Coop. That's COUPE. And wow, what a machine. You can check that out online if you'd like to. That looks like it makes short work out of prep. But you got to be doing that all the time to want to lay down the funds for a machine like that. But still fun to watch the video. You can't believe what that thing will do. But, you know, with just your couple of knives and some peelers and the will and some herbs in the garden, you know, you can really make a great feast. So I'm just going to give out a few recipes now because, you know, all this time I've been holding out, and it's one of the things I like to do the most is cook with all this great food. So I'm going to lay down, and after I wrote it all out, I realized, well, yeah, these could be some nice holiday recipes. A couple of these would be really awesome for Thanksgiving, which is coming around the corner, probably the next big feast that's broadly celebrated. One of my favorites is either breadfruit mash or squash mash. So I'll steam up the breadfruit or some squash and basically get it till it's soft, fully cooked, peel it, and process it while it's still hot in the food processor with butter, salt, and pepper, or coconut oil if you prefer. And the breadfruit mash, I mean, it gets almost doughy. You know, lets breadfruit kind of live up to its ready dough name. It's not quite poi. I wouldn't call it poi, but it really is delicious. And squash, too. So that's just another alternative to, you know, potatoes, buying potatoes, which aren't widely grown here. But you can make a great mash out of either one of those. And breadfruit, since it is in season still and will be through January, you know, now's the time. And we've talked a lot about breadfruit in the past, but one of my favorite recipes that my friends asked me to make over and over again is breadfruit au gratin. And so basically I cook the breadfruit whole once again, steam it till it's done, peel and slice it, and then I add it to a casserole with savory herbs. You know, I love the thyme and rosemary and oreganos. With that one, some garlic, perhaps.
No bacon in there?
Well, yeah, I do. Then I make a roux, which, if anybody knows what a roux is, it's kind of a classic cooking cream sauce. So you, or gravy, you saute a little oil. You put a couple teaspoons of flour. You kind of fry up the flour. And you add some kind of milk until it's thick. It can be coconut milk or cow's milk or almond milk, whatever you like. Boil it up so it gets kind of thick. And then I pour that roux over the casserole. Probably throw in a little bit of cheese. You can't go wrong there. And I like to add sausage. And I've been lucky enough to get on with some of this wild boar sausage around town. That's really, really nice in there. Mix that up nicely and cook it for about an hour at 375. Now, if you're using a wood-fired oven, that definitely is a trick to know what temperature you're at and how long you need to be cooking it. And I can't really say with authority yet because I'm still learning, and I'm thinking that everybody's oven, a wood-fired oven that's been built, is kind of going to hold and retain heat differently, so you kind of have to learn your own unit there. So I can't.
You've got a super cool laser temperature gauge.
That's right. At Home Depot, you can get this laser beam thermometer. So you just shoot inside the oven there, and you know what temperature you're at, just like that. It definitely works better than the old-fashioned kind.
Outrageous.
Yeah. And then kabocha squash, another really great, beautiful fall food. I mean, they grow year-round here, and we eat them all the time, but certainly one that most people think of around the holidays here. I think for roasted kabocha, the way I like to do it, really the most important thing is just a perfectly high-quality squash. You need one that's dark orange and sweet. It's just going to make it all better. If the squash was picked a little too young, the flavors really haven't developed. But this particular little rub I do on them, so cut the squash into 1 or 2 inch chunks, put it in a big bowl, and I dry toast anise seeds, coriander seeds, and chili flakes. Now, I've learned the hard way here in the tropics that I don't keep powdered spices anymore, because I don't use them fast enough, and inevitably I open the jar and they've gotten moldy, and it's really sad because they're not cheap and we don't like to waste. So I just keep whole seeds now, and I grind them as I need them because they don't tend to go off quite as quickly. So in a little skillet, I dry toast those three things, and then I grind them right before I want to use them into a coarse powder. And I'll toss the squash with a little olive or coconut oil with that spice mixture. And then when you roast vegetables like that, I think the most important thing is to lay them flat on a baking sheet with a little bit of space in between them. You don't want to crowd them because you want to get a little brown crust on them.
On every surface.
On every surface. And if they're crowded and touching, they won't get that brown so easily. Mm. So basically, after you do that, at 375, about 45 minutes to an hour, you can pierce it with a fork and make sure it's done. And that squash is great as is, or as an ingredient in some other thing. And I love roasted squash.
Yeah. Mac makes an excellent roasted squash just right on the countertop if you don't have an oven. Just, again, using a Dutch oven.
Mm.
And, yeah, Mac has made my mouth water on a number of occasions with that particular...
Yeah.
Something very close to what you described.
Cutting them in crescents is a nice way, too, because squash are round. If you make crescent moons, they'll cook very fast if you just make them about a quarter to a half an inch thick. Mm. You'll cut down on your cooking time. They take up more space. But so that's it on veggies. I mean, here we are, the feast. I'm just going on and on with the recipes. I hope everybody's cool with that.
Oh, it's good.
And so the next one is in honor of, you know, the Hawaiian love for pork. But my version is green. I call it green chili pork or green pork. And basically you get some nice pork, either shoulder roast or pork loins, whatever you can get your little fingers on. Local, hopefully. I know Kaneshiro Farms on Kauai offers their locally grown up pork at Big Save, so you can get some local meat there.
And let me just ask you, are there pieces of the pig that you would not use? Because I'm hearing shoulder and loin, but
right,
there are other parts that wouldn't be as good for this recipe.
You know, if only I were a little more skilled in charcuterie. I'm not. I'd love to learn that skill. Actually, I'd love to see something like that come to Kauai. We have
What is the word you're using?
Charcuterie is basically like the French way to say butchery. And learning what the cuts are and what they're best for. Okay. I just don't have a skill for that. Yet to be learned by me. You take that pork, you cut it into 1 or 2 inch chunks again, and you sear it in a hot pan just quickly. You're just sealing the edges, and then put it in a Dutch oven with approximately 20 tomatillos, 6 poblano peppers, an onion all chopped up, salt and pepper, and really, it's unbelievable, but that's it. Put the lid on and slow cook it until the meat falls apart. I mean, if you're doing it in your wood oven, keep your eye on it. Your liquid's not going to disappear. The tomatillos just turn to sauce.
Not salt, though.
Yeah, salt and pepper. And that is really one of my favorite things to eat in the whole wide world. If you want to go out to sea and catch some fish, you know, one of the certainly the most sustainable fish we can eat here on Kauai would be, you know, smaller reef fish, although we do have to be careful at what time of year we eat what because of that nasty bacterial disease called Ciguatera. So I'm not going to make any recommendations on which fish because, again, I'm not skilled in which ones are good or not. But if you go into your bigger fish, you know, somebody's fishing that. Hopefully it's pole caught by local fishermen. We definitely don't like to support the longline fishers because they have such a bad impact on the ocean as a whole. So if you can find find some pole caught fish. But this, if you remember, a few weeks ago we talked about canoe plants and the tea leaf and how the tea leaf was so used in food preparation. And it's really steaming fish in tea leaf is one of the best ways to eat it. It's so delicious. So if it's a small fish, you can use it whole after you eviscerate it, or you can fillet it and wrap those up in tea leaves, and you can use, you know, natural fibers to close the tea leaf packets. And I like to do a little bit of pressed garlic or finely minced garlic and salt and pepper and a little oil rubbed on the fish, and then wrap it in the tea leaf. Steam it in a steamer pot until just done, maybe 15 to 20 minutes maximum, depending on the size of the fish. And so, God, I'm already full just talking about all that. But that's one of the big issues around feasting is digesting. We tend to, when we get into feasting, we can just overeat. You know, that's pretty normal. And so I don't know why. I don't have the whys about this, but I grew up Italian, and we always ate our salad after dinner. And I think it has something to do with digesting your food better, the fiber of the salad, but definitely want to always have a salad with your meal. Some crunchy, fresh vegetables are so good. Mm-hmm. So one of my favorite ways to make a big salad is to go pick a couple of nice big banana leaves and handle them really gently so they don't split or break, and lay them out, and then chop up all of my veggies and tear up all the greens that I'm going to use and just toss it right there on the banana leaves with a simple dressing. And a friend of mine just turned me on to this one, which I'd like to share, is a lemon turmeric vinaigrette. But the difference is you actually saute the powdered turmeric a little bit. You can also use fresh and mince it finely and saute it. But fry the turmeric and then make the vinaigrette. So lemon, your fried turmeric, a little bit of vinegar of your choice. Either, you know, I like apple cider or red wine vinegar or white wine vinegar. Doesn't really matter. Oil and salt and pepper, and toss your salad with that. And if you go ahead and toss the salad with the dressing, you'll use less dressing at the end of the day, and so it's just healthier for you in general. And I think the salad also, personally, my taste says it tastes better when all of it's coated. You just want to make sure that you eat it, because dressed salad doesn't hang around very long after it's dressed, so you want to make sure you don't overdo that. That should do it for you as far as digestion goes, but there are digestive aids.
Well, we're familiar with the green papaya and its powerful enzymes, and whether you purchase it as a tablet or you just include green papaya in your food, that's a powerful one. And I was recently at a restaurant in California, and it was a great Italian restaurant. I wish you were there, Robin, but they had their list of digestives, which were all of the aperitifs at the end of the meal. Now, I'm not sure whether or not that's just people telling themselves that it's good for their health to have a nice little drink of something at the end, or whether or not that bears out. But certainly digestive bitters are good. Anything that bitter flavor is really good for digestion as well.
And anise and fennel both also. Mm-hmm. In Indian restaurants, you know, they have those little anise or fennel seeds
right.
as you leave,
yes.
and they're chewed upon. And that anise flavor or fennel flavor apparently has some help for digestion and, you know, blocking gas and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And my favorite digestivos or after-dinner drinks are definitely fennel-based, no doubt about it.
Nice.
Yeah.
And really any of the culinary herbs not only add the flavor, but they do stimulate the digestion as well. And that's something that I think is missing, I find often is missing when I'm at a luau, is just the plainness of the food. And it's really hard because it's kind of the biggest feat you're asking your body to do maybe all year is to digest this ginormous luau, but without those digestive cues or those stimulants.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've become a fan at least of the idea of bringing some, you know, and discreetly sharing with maybe your neighbors, but to dress up a little bit of that luau food with maybe a little sauce or something to bring the moisture, the flavor, and the digestive qualities into the experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I'm a big fan that cooking, getting it into the food so it can cook in there really can make a big difference, too, in how the food goes down and sits with us. You know, I realized I was supposed to read this little announcement earlier in the show, so I'm going to interrupt our conversation for just a second to let everybody know that there's the Black Pot Beach Park Master Plan Community Meeting that was set for tomorrow, Thursday, October 29th, has been rescheduled, and it's almost a month later. So the rescheduled Black Pot Beach Park Master Plan Community Meeting is rescheduled until Tuesday, November 17th, from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at the Hanalei Elementary School Cafeteria. And if you have, if you need any help or information about it, you can call Nancy McMahon at 808-241-4459.
Thank you.
Yes.
So we're going to finish up the show with a talk about the secrets of the soil builders.
Yes.
We've got a few announcements following that. But we love to talk about compost on the show. And as we're thinking about all the various elements that we can reveal some knowledge on, we discovered that we'd never really talked about that process of screening the compost, which is not something I've discovered everyone does or thinks is important, but I certainly do. What do you think, Robin?
I do, too. I didn't always, and I have become a convert to screening. Maybe just because I'm so much more diligent about my compost than I ever have been. And when I screened it, it's just like, oh my God, you feel so good about putting that in your bed. What I like actually about the compost screen is it's one of those things that you can't even buy it. You have to make it. I don't know of a single compost screen that is marketed out there on the internet anywhere. This is a custom tool here. And I like these because they make us really think about it and think about what do we need. And when it came to design elements for me, basically I want it to be the same size, the perfect size for my wheelbarrow.
Mm-hmm.
Wheelbarrows are generally the same size. So, you know, that's, and you want some sturdy 2x4s for your frame. And I personally like 1/4-inch screen, which is pretty fine. So, not going to work real great probably for vermicompost. Because you're just going to kind of obliterate your worms by rubbing them through, and that wouldn't be nice. Definitely not nice to worms in general. The compost screen is not a worm-friendly tool.
It certainly is not. And, yes, many apologies have been made to our wormy friends and
yes.
and wishes that a divided worm made two worms, which we've discovered is not true of many worms.
Sure, not the case, but the screenings, the stuff I screen out, mm-hmm. I get so excited about putting it in my other compost pile, right? Because I try to keep two going, and I'm like, wow, I'm inoculating again and again and again. You know, every time I use a little bit of compost, I'm taking those bigger bits and giving them another chance to compost in the second. And I'm sure eventually they do.
Yes, they do indeed. And it is important to consider it's not just an aesthetic thing, but we're actually giving ourselves a leg up on the efficacy or the value of adding the compost. Oftentimes these bits that we're screening out are more high carbon to nitrogen ratio bits, woodier bits, or fibrous bits from the plant matter that we are composting. And if incorporated in the soil, would rob nitrogen from our soil and for the resulting plant growth. And so it's important to get them out for that reason. I know for me, inevitably, I'm finding, because I do use, I get coffee grounds from various stores or things. Inevitably, it seems I'm screening out plastic from the compost, mm-hmm. even though it's not coming out of my kitchen so often. But sometimes a kitchen fork does come out of the compost pile, which is always a happy occasion.
Isn't it? Oh, missing. My long-lost spoon that I loved so much. There it is.
Totally.
Yep.
And then even rocks are screened out. And I think it's probably better, too, when we have some more things. You know, big blocky material can still be kind of putrid, and that probably isn't very good to have in your garden beds. We'll also find that during the screening process that there could still be a lot of insect life in the compost, too. And while not always a problem, all of those little pill bugs that we see can actually nibble on our new seedlings if we incorporate them into the garden beds. And it's not so much that we're going to get them out during the screening process, but when we do the screening and we have this fine textured material, it's a lot easier to see all these little creatures, and an easy way to get them out is to spread your compost in a thin layer, as thin as you can, on a tarp in the sunlight.
Oh, and they just head for the hills.
They'll head for the dark and moist places, and you can rid it of that particular issue. So compost screens, there are, of course, commercial varieties. You can purchase them if you have a big commercial process.
And oh, sure.
I was surprised to see how commonplace the circular drums, also known as trommels, are utilized for this purpose. This is a device that was actually developed to screen out ore. So like in the mining process of separating different kinds of rocky material, but is now being employed for screening compost, for screening vermicompost even. And so there's some great descriptions and plans on the internet for that kind of a system, and you could even create one with the rings of a barrel. You know, the old wooden barrels can produce the rings, or the tops of a 55-gallon drum have rings that you can use to develop this circular hardwire cloth screen that then can be utilized. So I've got a bit more research to do there, but I agree with you. It's great to have a screen that just fits right over the top of the wheelbarrow. And then once you've screened it, the wheelbarrow is just ready to go into the garden.
Exactly. And, you know, again, because we like tools that have multi-purposes, I also use said screen to screen out nut grass of soil when I have to.
Excellent.
It doubles really nicely for that. And what I've learned is when you push hard on the screen, if you're trying to really screen things through and you're pushing on it, the staples or however the screen itself was attached to your frame can let go, and then you end up with a gap. And so using a little trim, you know, on top of the screen to just hold it there in place.
So the screen is actually sandwiched between two pieces of wood, one of them being the big 2x4 and the other one being just a little face of wood.
Exactly. That's what I like. And it helps it move easier on the wheelbarrow. And, you know, it just makes it so that you have a good quality tool that you're not going to have to play, you know, mess with. I'm sure we've all used sort of like crappy screens and, you know, nice to have a nice one.
Indeed. Well, we've got time for enough for just a few announcements about some cool workshops and different things coming up soon. We want to let you know about the One Song Farm Garden and Permaculture Workshop. This is a two-part workshop happening Sunday, November 15th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the beautiful One Song Farm in lush Kilauea area. Sun Hadley, Olivia Wolf, and Chuck Esten will be the instructors. And the day is split into two parts. From 9 to noon is going to be the garden workshop. It'll be split into two basic and advanced learning tracks. So if you're in the advanced group, you'll really be getting in-depth on soil fertility, soil analysis, biointensive gardening strategies, and more. If you're in the basic group, getting started with bed preparation, composting, starting your plants, that kind of thing. And then the afternoon from 1 to 4 p.m., the permaculture workshop with some great in-depth processes and examples shown at One Song Farm. They've got some great systems set up there. They put in a pond. There's really great stuff to see and learn there, and I imagine Chuck's going to be leading some of that instruction. So reservations are encouraged, as the workshop may reach capacity before the day arrives of the workshop. You can be in touch with Chuck at cestin at gmail.com or call 652-1591. There's also a wild food book tour coming up with Sunny Savage coming over from, I think she's on the Big Island. She's just penned a new book on wild food of Hawaii, a beautiful book. I haven't had it in my hands yet, but it sure is gorgeous to look at on the Internet. She's going to be here in November, November 20th, Lydgate State Park, a wild food hike. She'll be in Hanapepe on the 20th as well at Talk Story Bookstore. And then in, let's see, on the 23rd, she'll be in Waimea. She'll also be doing a book signing at Anainaho on November 21st in the Kilauea area. For more information about the tour, and she will be visiting other islands, and so she might be coming to your island as well, you want to check out Sunny Savage, S-U-N-N-Y, Savage, S-A-V-A-G-E.com, or you can call her. Perhaps to reserve a spot at 866-8294. We also have a couple of workshops coming up at the Food Forest soon. We'll be doing a follow-up pruning workshop, and we're also going to have a biochar workshop with an expert coming in from Australia to teach us about the latest implementation of making biochar, utilizing biochar, a topic that's gained a lot of interest, and then some speculating whether or not it's really helpful with our particular soils. There's still a lot to learn, and I just met with this guy, Paul Taylor, when I was over in the U.S. Last week, and this guy knows a lot. He's already authored a book on the subject, and another one is coming up soon, and we'll have him here in mid-November. We'll let you know as soon as we announce that. And we're also going to be at the Food Forest this Saturday. We've got a new work schedule there, sort of smaller bites, bite-sized work sessions, the first one at 8:30 to noon, and the second one from 2:30 to 5. So those are two manageable sessions. You're certainly welcome to do both of them with me, but if you want to just take in one and have a good chunk of the rest of your Saturday to do something else, we're going to see if this fits good for our team. And come on out and check the Kauai Food Forest, kauaifoodforest.org, for more information.
And I'm just going to remind you one more time that the meeting that was set for tomorrow at the Hanalei Elementary School about the Black Pot Beach Park Master Plan has been rescheduled until Tuesday, November 17th, from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at the Hanalei Elementary School cafeteria. And if you need information, 808-241-4459. And you'll get some information. Or the project website, www.blackpotplan.com.
Aho. And we want to encourage you to stay tuned for Kauai Vibrations with our awesome brother,
Matt Morlock.
Yeah, in the studio, giving us a couple more minutes to get off the air. But we want to let you know that this has been In the Garden on the Farm on Kauai Community Radio with your host, Paul, and
Robin.
And we just want to send Robin along with so much love. This is her last show for now. So we'll say so long, but not goodbye forever. But Robin's been with us on the show for a few years now. I don't know how long it's been, 3 years?
Three or more.
Four.
Yeah.
And it's just been the greatest time with you. And I'm excited that you are pouring all the energy that you've put into the garden show here. You're putting more into your own garden and into your own business that provides so much productivity and prosperity for the gardeners around the island with your organic vegetable starts, on earth. So God bless you. I love you so much. And I know that our listeners will continue to seek you out at the Kilauea Farmers Market and around the island for your amazing inspiration, your generosity, and your love.
Well, thank you, Paul. I've so enjoyed it.
All right.
Aloha.
We love you, KKCR, and we're going to go out with Makana with track number one.
11.
Okay,
please.
11. 11 is the one. We love you.